much worse than that. Let me tell you my church story. And they say, wait a minute, I thought you were a Christian writer. Well, I am, because getting to know God is worth whatever you have to put up with in the church. And in fact, that's God's choice.
Philip Yancey, the author of the new book, Where the Light Fell. He's also the author of, I don't know, almost like 20 books. I don't know the exact number. I've read a ton of them, and they've been super meaningful to me. Disappointment with God, brilliant. The Jesus I Never Knew, amazing. Soul Survivor, just fascinating. He's written a ton of books that are super, super amazing. And so when his publicist said, hey, do you want to have Philip Yancey on the podcast? I was like, of course. How have I gone this long without having Yancey on the podcast? And so I read this book, and it's a detour from his typical writing style and genre. He writes a memoir this time. And it's pretty heavy. There's a lot of stuff in there that is super impactful and meaningful. But as like I start this conversation, I'm like, hey man, your book kind of left me depressed at the end. You know, because it kind of did. He's going to say some stuff on the podcast that I really wish you would have had at the end of the book, which is some really great news. But I think this conversation with Philip is great. You're going to love it. If you've never read his stuff before, I hope you find this as a chance to start getting into Philip Yancey. Now, let me say something else about the podcast. I've gotten a few complaints about like the audio levels, especially with the new intro and all that stuff. And I want you to know, I hear you. I hear you. One of my coworkers actually said, dude, you need some help on this. And he luckily has won like 10 Dove Awards, so he's a music guy and knows how to fix this. So anyway, yeah, I'm making the audio a little louder. So for those of you who've had issues with that, thank you for listening and reaching out to me. Hopefully it's louder. Hopefully you hear me. What I want you to know though is I hear you saying, Luke, I want you louder in my ears. And that is music to my ears that you want to listen to me. So thank you. And thank you for wanting to hear me louder. That means a lot to me. For all of you who don't want to hear me louder, you're dead to me. And we're no longer friends. But those of you who do, enjoy this podcast with Philip Yancey. All right, friends, welcome back to the show. Today, I am deeply honored to have Philip Yancey on the podcast. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you, Luke.
Yes, it is. It's an honor. I've been reading your books for years. I remember reading The Jesus I Never Knew when I was like 18 or 19, and it was deeply formative for me. And as someone who's written as many books as you've had, I assume you get that conversation many times. I assume as a writer, you probably still appreciate it, though. Am I right?
You're right. Most of my time, I'm locked in a basement office here, all alone, nobody in the room. And then every once in a while, they let me outside and the lights go on and I'll hear comments from people like that. And it seems strange, but that's the reason you keep going. You need those encouragements now and then.
Yeah, outstanding. Well, I'll tell you this. So reading the end of your book this morning, the new book is entitled Where the Light Fell. And so when I read, you know, The Jesus I Never Knew, or Disappointment with God?
Soul Searching with God, right?
Yeah, like I read those books, and those like inspired me. The Jesus I Never Knew really was formative for me to be like, okay, I want to be a Christian. I want to follow the way of Jesus. I actually want to devote my life to it. And so, a lot of your stuff was very hopeful to me. As I finished this book this morning, I found myself very somber and in a different state. So when you write an autobiography, I feel like you're probably hoping for a different outcome than your other works. Did you have a different goal of what you're hoping to accomplish in this one compared to the other books?
Yes, I did. I waited a long time. I'm 71 now, so I've waited 50 years to tell a lot of these stories. And I can understand why it might be a little surprising if you've read my other nonfiction books, which are mostly grappling with spiritual issues and trying to come to terms with them. And then suddenly you read a book of stories, and they're not all uplifting stories, are they? There's some abuse involved there. There's some... I'll tell you why I wrote. First, I wanted to capture our little subculture, our fundamentalist evangelical subculture. A lot of people came through that. There are about 100 million people in the U.S. who identify as evangelicals, and there are about 25 million or so who would call themselves ex-evangelicals. Used to be, you know, maybe they went to a summer camp, maybe they went to through Young Life or even a Christian college, but then they threw it all away. And when I'm around those people, I think what I grew up with was so much more toxic than what they're describing. And yet I learned you can survive, you can live through it. And it's worth hanging in there to find what's on the other side. So I went through that bad church experience and did kind of suspend my faith for a period of time. But I found the problem was I had been lied to by the church. I had been given the wrong, I'd been given the bad news rather than the good news. And the good news is there, and it's worth looking past the church experiences I grew up in to find later in life.
Yeah. You described a memoir as a verbal selfie, which I feel like that's a pretty great definition of what it is, especially for this present time. You also mentioned that you feel like the media is tone deaf to the portrayal of Christians, that the media really struggles with that.
The media, especially in recent times, judges everything through the political lens. So if you say, what in New York, you stop somebody and say, what is an evangelical Christian? They'll say, oh, it's one of those right-wing, Trump-supporting, redneck racists. Well, I mean, I grew up around these people, so I know them well. And even in the worst churches, you're going to find people who are doing prison ministries, who are working in homeless shelters, pregnancy counseling, those kind of places. And the media doesn't get that. They don't get that our motivation can be different than that political motivation of winning and coming out on top. Yeah, the church gets it wrong a lot. And I'm quite honest in my book about how the church got it wrong that I grew up in. But I later found healthy churches, grace-filled churches, churches that were doing it right. And you don't see a lot of that in the media.
Yeah. And I feel like the way you tell your story gives more shades to what the like the black and white sort of narrative that we hear so often. It kind of gives a fuller picture of that. And I mean, it's not always a beautiful picture, but it is a true picture. And as you know, someone who grew up in a very conservative Church of Christ, evangelical upbringing, and for part of my life I lived in the rural Southeast Ohio. Some of this stuff, obviously, I'm a few decades younger than you, but I can see what you're describing, and I can see kind of the long-term effects of it in like the religious tradition that I'm a part of. And so I appreciate the way that you've done that. I heard someone say years ago that all theology is autobiography. And while that might be a bit of an overstatement, when I hear your story, and then as someone who's read your books for years, it seems that your story has always been incorporating some of these harder subjects, even if they've never been articulated. Do you think that's a fair read on your work?
I do. I mentioned in the very last chapter, it's kind of a wrap-up chapter, that writing a memoir is kind of like putting together a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle without a picture on the cover to guide you. And here I was putting all these little pieces together. And then at the end, I could look back and say, oh, it's obvious to me now that the themes that occur in my books over and over are suffering and grace, pain and grace. And now I understand why, because from the very opening chapter, I start talking about how pain was an important part of my life when my father died of polio after a tragic misunderstanding and belief in faith healing by people who loved him. They were wrong, and he died, and that affected us forever. And those questions, why would God, quote, take a 23-year-old person who was planning to be a missionary? That's a question nobody can really answer. And I've been seeking answers to questions like that all my life. And then grace, I later found out it's what the Christian life is all about. It's for by grace are you saved, Paul says. Mm-hmm. And yet I didn't experience much growing up or in that subculture I came from. And if we're missing that, we're missing the key to what Jesus is like. We're missing the key to God's gift, because grace is God's gift to us, God's gift of forgiveness to people who don't deserve it. so many people go through life feeling undeserving, and they're right. None of us are deserving, but the grace is offered regardless.
Yes, sir. There's a chapter you wrote about why, I think the title was Why I Wish I Was an Alcoholic. And you talk about finding God in the 12-step program. And as I remember, I probably should have fact-checked it this morning, but there's a quote about someone that you met in the 12-step program, which, as I remember correctly, you're not actually a part of it, but you were someone who was like a...
Went with a friend, right.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Where a guy said that he... Every day he woke up and was thirsting for Jack Daniels. And after time, you started to realize that that thirst for Jack was actually like there's a deeper thirst that pulled him to God, right? Does that sound somewhat accurate to the story?
He said I would pray, my first prayer every day is, God, take away my thirst for Jack Daniels. And every day he would wake up and the first thing on his mind was, I want a Jack Daniels. And then later he realized, that's the reason he prays every day. The thirst kind of forces him to God. And he was sober. He finally passed away, but he was sober for, I think, more than 30 years in that period. And every day he faced that same prayer. It was never answered in the sense that God took away that thirst, but it was transformed. It was redeemed. And I think that's the promise. That's the same feeling I have about my background. There are things that I wish were different. I wish I had a different family, I had a different church. But actually, no, these things were all redeemed. They were used. And at the end of my life, toward, you know, as old as I am now, I look back and see how they do all fit together into a pattern that God has redeemed.
I was wondering if you were able to make a similar connection with the family situation that you were born into. Obviously, you know, your dad dies of polio. In the book, you talk about how you didn't know the full story until I guess you were around the college age, where you found out.
Right, I was 18. Mm-hmm.
Where he left the, I guess it was the iron lung, that was the treatment protocol at the time, and he went to this chiropractic center, which like didn't offer what he really needed. And up until then, you didn't know that this sort of like faith healing led them to this against doctor's orders decision. And so like you have this terrible secret that you figure out as an 18-year-old, your dad's gone. Like, do you ever connect the dots and go, somehow I'm thankful that this drew me to God, or how you could see that drawing you to God, that sort of tragedy that you're born into as just a baby?
Actually, that tragedy made it difficult for me to stick with God.
Yeah.
Because I saw that it was the Christians who were wrong. They were convinced he would be healed, and they spoke for God. They said, we believe it's God's will that he'll be healed, so we should remove him from the iron lung. And they were tragically wrong. And that happens again and again, where Christians say, I'm speaking for God, and it turns out they weren't. Yeah. They believed it's God's will that he will be healed. Well, it wasn't, evidently, because he died shortly after they took him out of the iron lung. And I was able to overcome that and understand how it all fit together. And my brother, on the other hand, was on a different track, and that derailed him, really. If Christians are like that, I don't want to be one of them. And that worked itself out in a very toxic way in our family, because my mother was a widow. She was deprived of her husband, and she placed all of her hopes and demands, really, in us, her children, and we never quite measured up. And because of that, my brother and mother have had no direct personal contact in 51 years.
Yeah, and the story doesn't end with a happy ending like we would want. And that was part of the somber tone that, like, I felt as I was reading the conclusion of the book. Is like, I wish it would have been different, in the same way I know you've probably prayed for that countless times. But when you have a trauma that... It's hard to like compare traumas, and I think it was Kate Bowler who said there's no such thing as the suffering Olympics. We're not like competing against each other for who's suffering is more. But the trauma that comes with being an alcoholic, where you have this constant longing for something that's ultimately leading to your demise, and then having the trauma of a toxic religious environment that you're born into, it seems like you step into the 12-step program and there's a way to align that and say, this is actually going to help you draw closer to God. When the trauma actually comes from people who are misspeaking for God, it seems like your brother's response is the only one that makes sense. Yet you're the guy who helps so many of us find faith. And so it just seems like the two paths that you and your brother took, it's almost like, are you familiar with Johnny Cash?
Sure.
I heard, I think it was his daughter who said that the trauma that he went through, his brother dies, he has a parent, I think, blames it on him, that I think the daughter said the suffering that he went through, there was only like two outcomes, like great good or great bad. And in some ways, like deep trauma, like for a lot of us, it seems like the middle road isn't happened. It seems like there's extremes on both ends. Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah, it does, Luke. And one of the best books I have read on pain, I've written some myself, and so I turned to really good books. And one is The Problem of Pain by C.S. Lewis. And he calls pain the megaphone of God. He said that God whispers to us in the good times and shouts to us in the bad times. And I've always kind of winced at that image, because what comes to my mind is a football coach on the sidelines with a megaphone yelling at his players, do 50 more push-ups, 5 more laps around the field, you know, that kind of thing. And I don't think God is the coach with the megaphone and say, oh, I'm going to make that family over there suffer. I'll give their 3-year-old leukemia. You know, I'm sure that's not God. Mm-hmm. The image I like is very much what you were implying there, and that is, when pain happens, it's like we have a hearing aid. We can either turn it up or turn it down. My brother, when he was confronted with some of the bad stuff, he immediately said, well, if that's the way God is, if that's the way Christians are, I won't have anything more to do with him. Just turns it off. Drops out of school, Christian college, becomes a hippie, uses a lot of LSD, runs to California to join other hippies, and has had a pretty difficult and sad life. Mm-hmm. In my case, and I tell the story of my conversion in the book, it wasn't something I was seeking at the time, but I was, in a sense, rescued by God, and I turned the hearing aid up. How in the world can what I've been through be used by God? Well, I came away from that church with a lot of biblical knowledge, with a lot of discipline, and a lot of warnings against what not to do. I didn't like all those at the time, but I had that pattern. And indeed, that's why I like that term, redeemed. Doesn't mean things are erased. You know, even a slave who's been redeemed still bears the scars of what that slave went through. And we don't have a promise that only good things will happen to you. You mentioned Kate Bowler. She's so strong on that. She takes on those cliches, everything happens for a reason, and says, no, not necessarily true, but everything can be used for good.
Yeah, I think you and I had different experiences with football coaches. As you describe in the book, that wasn't necessarily your best experience when you were in high school.
You're right.
So we have different metaphor, like we have different connections with that metaphor. But you definitely, when you said, yeah, I've read a few books on like suffering and pain, and I kind of giggled because I was like, yeah, because yours are the books that I always recommend on that subject. So that was a interesting moment there for me. But you talk about your brother, and so the comparison that is on like the cover of the book, and I think the email that I got from your publicist was J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy. And
right.
As someone from like who lived in rural Southeast Ohio, J.D. Vance's story is set in Ohio, and I can connect to a lot of what he went through. And if you read his story, the mom went through a lot and wasn't necessarily the positive like representation of like this divine love that you see in the scriptures of the parental figure. And in the book, like you quote a piece that says that you know, you've written at the time it's like 15 books and your mom didn't read any of them, and
right,
your mom's not like, I don't know how to say this nicely, but like your mom doesn't seem like that supportive of what you're doing. And actually she seems to in some ways be the I mean, if you're plotting this out in a movie, like she's kind of like the villain that your brother has to overcome. And like, it's terrible to say that about your mom, but as the story goes, like, she, you know, her husband dies, she's very young, she makes this like vow that becomes a curse for you guys, that she expects you guys in some ways like live up to this missionary status. And how do you reconcile when you're writing about, you know, God's love and grace, and you have this fractured relationship with your mom this entire time, and your brother has this, you know, tough, tumultuous relationship. Like, how do you write about like God and love and all that when like in the background of your life is what a lot of people would describe as like chaos and turmoil?
Mm. Well, you obviously read the book, Luke. I thank you for that. Not everybody who interviews me does, but I grew up in what I call ungrace. It's the opposite of grace. And the church was very strict. My image of God was this scowling policeman up in the sky, just waiting to see anybody having fun so they could squash him. You know? Yeah. And that was my view of God. And it was a racist church. So one of the biggest hurdles I think we as Christians face is being around people who are different than we are. That's where grace is put to the test. It doesn't take a lot of grace to be around somebody who's just like you, who agrees with you, votes with you, smells like you, dresses like you, is as educated and literate, likes the same kind of coffee. You know, that doesn't take grace. That's just fun. That's friendship. But we are called, Paul was very clear, you got slaves and free people, men and women, Jews and Gentiles. We're supposed to be showing the love of God, God's love of diversity for others. And my little church didn't do that, and my own mother didn't do that, because she judged us by her standards. And we're always in danger of falling into the trap of the Pharisees, of looking down on other people. You're not as good as I am. And we start, one of the things you hear about Christians is, oh, they're holier than thou, meaning they think they're better than you are. And Jesus is pretty clear. Here's the standard. The standard is to be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. And by that standard, you've all missed. So you're in this together. And that's one of the things I took away from the recovery movement, that you can only grow if you admit, I need help. I'm not making it on my own. I need help from a divine power. I need help from other people around me. Just that humbling. But so often, these little tiny narrow churches, such as I grew up in, it was probably sparked by fear of the big bad world around us. But instead, we had our own little community, and we started judging everybody else as not as good as we were, not as spiritual as we were. And as soon as we do that, there we are, right in the trap of the Pharisees.
Yeah. When I was probably 26, 27, I was working at a church in the Metroplex, Dallas, Fort Worth, and the executive minister there was going through an awful situation. His wife was dying from cancer, and he had lost his first wife when he was around my age from cancer as well. And so he was losing his second wife. He was probably 50 years old. And what stood out to me at that season was he would come to work and like be positive and do his job and obviously go rush and support his wife and his family during that time. But he kept going, not in like I'm covering up the adversity I'm going through, but just we got to keep going with life. And it didn't make sense to me as a 27-year-old how you could do that. You've obviously had to do that. And if I was coming to you as a 27-year-old going, I don't understand how people can do this to keep going in the midst of like all this turmoil behind the scenes, what would you like coach me up and give me advice on how to keep doing that? Because obviously, you've had to do that for a long time.
One of the first things I'd say would be find a mentor who would go in the trenches with you. And my own faith was quite confused and just taking shape, just forming for years. And in that process, I found a man, Dr. Paul Brand, who I ended up writing three different books with. And that gave me, it was like a cocoon period of my own faith so that I could try to figure things out while being under the tutelage of a great man who had figured them out. And sometimes that can be hard to do, depending on where you are, but seek out the kind of person you want to be like.
That's good.
In a godlike way. and just ask, could you be my mentor? In my case, became kind of a father figure to me because I didn't have a father. But that, and find what I call a doubt companion, somebody who doesn't reward you, who does reward you for your honesty. You know, often you go to church, if you stand up and say, I'm a mess right now, I don't believe any of this stuff anymore, people don't handle that very well. But you need to find a person who can do that. And the Bible does that. I mean, read the Psalms, read Job, read Habakkuk. There's a lot of doubt and distrust. And God understands that. He puts those examples in the Bible so that we won't feel alone. But it works best if you can find a flesh and blood human being to be one of those companions who can help you and stick with you through those hard times and kind of nudge and guide a little bit along the way.
Yeah. I mean, that's great advice. I mean, we all need a sounding board. We need people to support us. We can't do this alone. And it sounds like those figures have been extremely beneficial for you and helpful for you and the trajectory of your life and your faith. And I think for a lot of people that grow up in really confining legalistic and religious environments, it's like all or nothing. Like they just go away. But you've been able to look at that positively and to celebrate some of the stuff, like your discipline, mm-hmm. your knowledge of scripture. I think it's Richard Rohr who has the line about transcend and include. So you transcend where you came from, but you want to include some of the best stuff about it. And obviously it sounds like you have, you know, you took the discipline, you took the, you know, scripture, like those are things that you brought with you. How were you able to distinguish between things that you wanted to include as you move forward, but things that you knew that you need to transcend and leave behind? Obviously we'll get into racism a little bit more, but that was something that you like just let go of, you moved past. How did you do that? What was the process like to figure out this is stuff I can take with me and this is stuff that I need to leave behind?
My process was real simple. I'd write a book about it. So a lot of people, you go into a Christian bookstore, and there aren't that many left these days, but you go into, and many of them are written by experts, by a professor, by a theologian, whatever. And I'm not that, and I'm not a pastor. I am a reporter. I'm a journalist. And so if you go back to my books, you can kind of see where I was at the time. First book was a book called Where Is God When It Hurts? So I'm trying to figure out, why do these bad things happen? And why does the church get it wrong so many times when people are suffering and hurting? Next book was Disappointment with God. There I am, right smack in the middle of that again. And it was only years later that I could write books like The Jesus I Never Knew. But once again, that's the grappling. I don't believe Jesus is like the Sunday school caricature I was brought up with. So what is Jesus really like? I want to find out. So when I want to find out, I write a book about it. Yeah. Or prayer, does it make any difference? You know, these people, I've never felt good about my prayers. So I don't write a book when I've got something figured out. I write a book when I want to try to learn from others and figure it out. Mm-hmm. And that's really been my process. And I just feel blessed to be able to make a living. You know, I want to struggle with those questions anyway. And at the same time, other people say thank you and they'll buy my book and I can struggle with the next thing that comes along.
Well, as one of those people, thank you for writing the books. I'm glad that worked out for you. I don't know if everyone can do that, though. I don't think everyone can.
Yeah, right.
Like for someone else, then, like what do you think you would recommend? I mean, obviously the writing process for you is as much about learning for yourself as it is for sharing with the rest of the world. Wait, first of all, is that fair to say?
It is.
Yeah. Okay. So then,
in fact, mostly that it's that. Yeah.
Okay. So then is there a way that you would recommend someone else could have a similar experience if they're not going to, you know, be a published author?
I think it normally does not happen in a large room with a professional standing up in front of a large crowd talking down to them. I mean, that's what a lot of churches are. And I'm very pro-church. I've always gone to a church faithfully. But that's not where people really get vulnerable. In fact, quite the contrary, often when they go to church, they think, well, I've got to put on a nice front. I got to act like I'm a good Christian, you know, and you don't feel like a good Christian inside, but you feel that disconnect. it usually will happen in a Bible study group, a small group, and often those are spawned by churches and led by churches. So I'm not anti-church at all. But in terms of coming, really getting honest about the stuff that's going on, if you're in a room with someone whose five-year-old just got, like this morning, I heard Kate Bowler on an interview, and she was being interviewed by a person whose three-year-old just had stage 4 cancer. And even in that interview on the radio, suddenly there was this intensity, this emotional intensity between the two of them that you're not going to get in a church service normally. It takes that kind of personal contact. So I'm a big believer in small groups and in recovery groups and any group like that who encourages radical honesty, yeah, frankly.
No.
Because that's not necessarily the spirit people have when they go to a church. Often they're trying to look good, not be honest. Hmm.
Well, I would like the record to show that you've never listened to my sermons, so I would assume you'd have a different opinion if it was my sermons you're talking about. But for the
right.
rest of us, I think, no, I'm joking. I do think that sort of like intense, honest community is central for anyone's spiritual formation. One of the things that you talk about having this transformation is what you mentioned before, that you grew up racist. I feel like this is I don't know how to say that like nicely. There's no nice way to say that, actually. But you talk about growing up in an environment where you were taught and you consumed and believed a lot of, you know, racism. And that's gotta be a hard thing to write about, because you have family that's still alive. I think about like J.D. Vance's book, and I'm like, it seems like a book like that can be written like when you don't have people around. But I guess if your mom's not going to read your book anyway, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Anyway, so it's just kind of painful to read that, knowing, okay, these are other people around that, like, this is their story as well. But as someone who's, you know, I live in Texas, and I've lived in Atlanta for a summer, and like, I've been in the South long enough to know that there are a lot of people who don't feel like they're trying to be terrible, but they believe some racist stuff, and it's hard for them to have growth. There was a gentleman, a Dr. Cherry, I think was his name, who is that fair to say, like, one of the first people of color that you knew or early on in life? Is that right?
It is true. We were taught, I don't know if you've ever heard of this, but it was the curse of Ham theory. Did you catch that anywhere along the way, Luke?
I have, yes, I've heard that. I was never taught that, but I've read it. Yes.
You read it, yeah. And it goes like this, that Noah in Genesis 9 got drunk and was naked. Something weird happened. We don't know many details. And he cursed his grandson, Canaan. But somehow that got applied to Ham, his son. And Ham's, the name in Hebrew means burnt black. So therefore, Africans were cursed to serve in the tents of his brothers. And we were told directly in summer camps and in church that a person of color could never be the CEO of or president of a company. Could never have a job like that. They could be good waiters. They could pick cotton. They could do things like that, but never be a CEO. Well, I happened to win a summer fellowship at the Communicable Disease Center, as it was called then, Center for Disease Control now. And I knew that my supervisor was a distinguished PhD from an Ivy League school. So I studied up on his specialties before I got there. And when I went into his office, I almost dropped my stack of papers because he was a black man. And I was taught in church that a black person could never get a degree like that, could never be a supervisor like that. And I realized the church had lied to me. And if they lied to me about race, maybe they lied to me about other things, about Jesus, about the Bible. That was a major crisis of faith for me at the time.
Not everyone gets to meet a Dr. Cherry. Not everyone gets that experience to have someone that just goes, wait a minute, this doesn't fit with what I've been taught.
Well, we had a president of the United States who was African American, so.
No, I mean, at 2021, you'd think that that we'd be past this, but it seems like, anyway, I don't know. We are not. Yeah. But it, like, the power of having someone, flesh and blood, that you get to see in front of you, that goes, this is like the personification of the antithesis of what you've been taught, where you go, I can't, right, you know, look down and go, like, you know, people of color can't do X, Y, and Z because I see it. It's in front of me. And to own up and say that, did you have, like, obviously I have reservation even just saying you were a racist. Did you have reservations writing this, like talking about this? What's your internal dialogue about having this conversation so publicly about your family?
Actually, I've been working on a long article that takes those race parts out, and it's called Confessions of a Racist. And we've got lots of books coming out. I've been reading them, White Fragility and How to Be an Anti-Racist, books like that, that explain what it's like to grow up African-American or a person of color. But I haven't read anything that says, here's what goes on inside of the mind of a racist, and here are the steps that it took to change that mind. And I think if we're going to overcome divisions, we need to understand. Jesse Jackson used to say, you got to understand the mind of the adversary. You have to think like they think, or otherwise you're never going to comprehend it. You're never going to come together. And so I'm trying to be honest. This is how I was raised. You know, it's a long time ago. This is 40, 50 years ago. And this is what it took to change me. Part of it was an experience like with Dr. Cherry. Part of it was just my shame over the jokes I had told, the way I had acted around people of color. And a large part of it for me was just I turned to books. And books like Black Like Me were transformative for me. The story of a man, a reporter, who actually turned his skin dark as an experiment and drove around Mississippi and Alabama, and the radically different ways he was treated with dark skin. Same person, but treated entirely differently with dark skin as opposed to white skin.
That that sounds like a Dave Chappelle sketch comedy, which just a little different. It sounds like you didn't see that one, but it's it's a little different, but it's the same idea. But I think your point is, if we don't make space to understand where people are coming from, we can never have honest dialogue. And if you don't understand that some people think, you know, it was the War of Northern Aggression, and that, you know, only 13% are enslaved, and so of course it wasn't about slavery, and, you know, this was, you know, lost cause, and like all these things that tell a story, tell a narrative that make you think certain things about the story that we find ourselves in. And I think that article would be helpful for people.
Mm. Well, you're right. You know, if you're in the North, how often do you think about the Civil War? Almost never. But in the South, every time you drive down the street in Atlanta, you see something about the Battle of Atlanta or a monument. Stone Mountain, the biggest landmark in Georgia, with these Confederate generals carved into it. You can't get away from it. And people don't like messing with your history.
No.
When they try to take down some of those monuments, you know, it brings up a lot of feelings. So feelings are still there in many ways.
Yeah. Yeah. You have a line in the book. Was it Percy Walker who said the reason the South has so many writers is because we lost the war?
Right, right.
Yeah, I mean, it...
Yeah, it was actually Walker Percy. Oh, you got it almost right.
Sorry. kind of off there, but, you know, Percy was in there somewhere. But yeah, I mean, that's deeply told stories that are, you know, deeply held stories that are, you know, part of the fabric of our country that we need to be honest about. And, you know, you write in the book about having this deep sense of, like, shame and guilt for swallowing and believing these lies. For some of us, like, you swallow a lie, whether it's about race or some other subject, and like the shame prevents you from acknowledging that it is a lie. And we would rather hold on to a mistruth that is comfortable inside of us than acknowledge and like bring out what is wrong. Like, how would you help us like go through that sort of like excavation of the soul? Because that can't be like easy.
What's striking to me is I thought we had lived through most of this. You know, I grew up during the civil rights movement, and we had such stellar examples, John Lewis and Martin Luther King and folks like that, who were Christian ministers, who were preaching nonviolence and exposing the evil that was there, the systemic racism that was there, that was actually legal at the time. And they made dramatic changes. And then the 60s came along, and the country was divided over the issues of war, and there would be marching in the street and bombings and on campuses of colleges. And here we are, what, 50 years later, and we're kind of doing it all over again, only without the moral leadership of people like Martin Luther King. Now it's just people screaming at each other across the barriers. And I keep looking for some people with moral leadership who can stand up and reach across the barriers. That's what's lacking in the United States now. It seems like it's true in Congress. It's true out in the streets and protest movements. There's just no dialogue, no civil discourse. And that's not a healthy sign for a society like ours.
No, I think you're definitely right. I think far too many things that we listen to are just a headline, and we'll just throw headlines at each other instead of having long form conversations or make space for that. And I appreciate you writing about it. And unfortunately, it isn't antiquated. It is a conversation that we still have to have. I want to talk about the end of the book for a second.
So
your brother has a stroke, and your brother, I don't know how to say this in a short version, but your mom and your brother have always had issues. He was the older, strong-willed child. I feel weird talking about like your brother to you and your mom to you. I don't know. Like, I've done a lot of these interviews, but they don't seem as uncomfortable to talk about as like the humanity in this one. You know, your brother's a stroke, and so he's, you know, physically struggling. He's had plenty of struggles throughout his life. One of the big ones, obviously, being his relationship with your mom. You continue to be there for your mom, but the relationship is just, it's tough. Your mom's in her 90s, and, you know, your brother isn't the same after a stroke. And so I think a lot of people, unfortunately, know the story all too well, like not the specifics of it, but just of a story that doesn't have this happy, like, ending that we all want. And how do you learn to receive grace and accept life for the reality that you've been handed when it's not like the outcome that anyone would want? How do you have peace, and how do you receive grace when there's no like beautiful ending to the story?
Actually, I've read too many Christian books that have a nice, sweet wrap up. Everybody's happy forever after ending. Yeah. And life is not like that. I mean, look at Jesus' stories. There are usually people who make wrong choices in the story. They forget going to the wedding. They make the wrong choice. And I'm just trying to tell the truth of one family with two sons. My brother absorbed a lot because he was older. He got most of the conflict growing up, and I would just kind of find a way out of it. And it caught up to him. He made a lot of bad choices. He became addicted to a lot of different things that were destructive for him. There is, however, hope even after I've written the memoir, Luke. For the first time, the three of us, my brother, my mother, and I, have been on phone conversations in the last couple of months. The book was already done, but it was the first time either had heard their voice in 51 years, a mother and her firstborn son. So she's 97. There's still hope. They've actually heard their voices. And my brother, after his stroke, was surrounded by Christians. He claims to be an atheist, goes to what he calls an atheist church, kind of an oxymoron there. But it's a humanist church that doesn't believe in God, really. But he has to acknowledge the people who are there for me, the people who helped me out, were the body of Christ, in the words we would use. And he does acknowledge that, and it kind of frustrates him. He wishes his kind of people would step up more, but it's the Christians who look out for him. And that's what we've been doing throughout the centuries. Eventually people say, I think I'd like to be more like they live than like I live. And that's my prayer for my brother as he's surrounded by people who do care for him.
I like that way better than the ending of the book. Can we add like a couple of pages just to get a little of that at the end of the book? That makes me really happy. I'm very happy for you.
Yeah. Maybe your podcast will help do that. So
let's. I hope so. Oh, that's great. What does it feel like for you to be on those phone calls?
I feel like the middleman. It's kind of strange. My mother will say, "Do you remember when, as a 6-year-old, you came down and announced that you had accepted Jesus Christ as your personal savior?" And my brother will say, "I'm an atheist." And my mother will say, "What did he say?" And I said, he said he's an atheist, Mother. "I don't believe you're an atheist." "I am too an atheist." It kind of goes like that. But you know what? At least they're talking. And I feel like the middleman, because very often my mother's hard of hearing, and very often she will ask the question to me, and then I turn around and ask it to my brother, and then he shouts it back to her. Mm-hmm. So it's a little odd, but it's progress. Baby steps, baby steps.
Yeah, it's progress. There's this, as I read the story about Jacob and Esau and the reconciliation they have. So, you know, Jacob ripped off his brother, they run away, and they have like this like great reunion, and they're going to go together. But then at the very end, like, Jacob says, "Oh yeah, I'll be there." And then he sneaks out and goes the other direction, and he kind of sneaks away.
Yeah.
It seems like reconciliation sometimes is like that, where you get, it's not perfect, but you're at least talking, you're having phone conversations, and oh, that just made my day. Like this, I'm really glad we did the podcast, because if I just read the book and didn't know that there was a happy ending, I would have been in a bad mood all day. So thanks for sharing the rest of the story.
Okay.
But the book, Where the Light Felt, like I really appreciate you writing this book. And I know it had to require some extra muscles that you hadn't used writing, you know, 15 plus books or whatever that are, you know, different genre. And so I'm really glad that you stepped outside your comfort zone and wrote this book, because it's deeply meaningful. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Luke. And it's actually people in Austin that I have in mind. Because I know there are a lot of people, you run into them. Some may stop into your church every once in a while, and maybe they have kind of a nostalgic memory of growing up in the church, but they've been burned ever since. And they know there's something there worth keeping, but is it worth all the hassle of going through the strange people in a church who are judgmental or make you feel bad or something like that? We all have different wounds. And when I'm around those people, I kind of lean back and say, "Oh man, it's much worse than that. Let me tell you my church story." And they say, "Wait a minute, I thought you were a Christian writer." Well, I am, because getting to know God is worth whatever you have to put up with in the church. And in fact, that's God's choice. He turned the whole thing over to us. And sometimes we really mess it up, and sometimes we get it right. And it took me quite some time to find a church that got it right. And along the way, I encountered God's grace. I encountered what a person looks like who truly is transformed by God. The people I was around growing up were made small by their faith. I didn't know anybody who was made larger by their faith. But since then, I've done that. And as a reporter, I've interviewed and gotten to know people who are fully alive. I think that's our goal, to be fully alive. And what we hear and what I believe, according to the Gospels, is that the only way you can do that is by connecting with God. Don't cut off that most important part of all. Jesus said, "I came to set you free." And if you're not free, then you got the wrong message. He said, "I came to bring you good news." And if it doesn't sound like good news, you got a distorted message. I certainly did for years.
Yeah.
But there is good news. There is freedom. There is abundance. Mm-hmm. The abundant life that Jesus promised. It's there. And it's worth pursuing despite the church, or sometimes in spite of it.
Yeah. Well, amen to that. And I appreciate the way that your books over all these years have helped point many of us to the goodness of God and the life that we can truly experience in God. So, Philip, this has truly been an honor. Thank you for the time. Thank you for writing the book. And best wishes. And your family will be in my prayers. Thank you.
I appreciate that. And thank you for reading it, Luke. Not everybody does.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's how, it is kind of sad. But anyway, it's a great book, so thanks.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it.